FW Gordon Hall, Reel 4.
You were talking about the troubles which arose with light tanks and how much was reported from the service. Of course, a constant trouble, which was aggravated by when heavier armaments were fitted and also when the armor basis of the tank was increased, as it was. The original light tanks had been 11 meters of armor, which was sufficient to keep out the ordinary armor-piercing 303. It was then discovered that the Mauser armor-piercing bullet had a higher penetration than our own 303, and in consequence, it would need 14 millimeters of armor on the tank to keep that out. And therefore, at one stage, I think with the introduction of Light Tank Mark VI, the armor basis was upped, which made the tank more heavier. And that, again, aggravated a problem with the tanks of that time, in that the turret was considerably out of balance. And if you were trying to train the gun on the side of a hill, you had the greatest difficulty in doing so. And that really suggested to me and others, I suppose, that one day, if not now, one would need to apply power to the control of a tank turret. And one of the things I was very intimately concerned with was the introduction, development of systems of powering tank turrets, applied initially to light tanks, but of course it became very much bigger than that. And all tanks, very soon afterward, had to have a power training power system applied to the training of the gun and the turret.
You found then, by your dealing with this problem that was coming from the regiment, the corps, that you developed with people from the user a new system, a new component.
Yes, you see, I knew a bit of this myself because it was becoming apparent when I had been in the light battalion. And so I went to the War Office, and I thought one of the things, if I might try and bend my energies to, if I do nothing else, is to see whether we can't produce a power gear to help these things. And I did. I think I'm responsible for the initiation of work on power gear for tanks, both with Lucas. Oliver Lucas had become a friend of mine, and so he took this up with great enthusiasm, and Lucas developed an electrical system of power gear for a tank. And Fraser Nash, whom I also knew, and who was primarily working on aircraft in a factory in Tolworth, he took this up with enthusiasm, and eventually we were able to get the finance for him to set up a factory under the War Office solely for the development and manufacture of hydraulic power gears for tanks. And at the same time, Messrs. Bolton Paul up in Wolverhampton were working on a similar thing, because they had done a good deal of work on the powering of aircraft turrets, because although an aircraft turret doesn't suffer from a severe out of balance and isn't very heavy, the wind resistance, if you're firing over the side, is such that you can't turn it against the wind, and therefore you must have power. And so they were halfway along the road.
So you developed this component with outside manufacturers.
Yes.
Did you have, first of all, to get War Office approval before?
Oh, well, I was in the War Office.
Did you have to get your senior command?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. By that time, when this really got going, Brigadier Martell was my immediate boss. He was deputy director, and he saw the need for it, and he helped me whenever he could, and which was mostly, of course, with finance, because these firms opened their mouths very wide when you wanted them to do anything, and you had to persuade the Treasury that this was a good way of spending the money. Later on, of course, when the war became much closer, the Treasury tended to sink into the background and you could get almost anything you wanted, but not in the beginning.
How quickly did this process take, if we keep to the turret idea, from your seeing the need and seeing developments, did you take the idea and get one of the firms to do a design? Or did you draw up the design yourself?
Oh, no, no, no. The only thing I personally drew up was the control characteristics of the whatever mechanism was used. I had a clear idea in my mind what sort of control, that is, the sort of deflection of controller plotted against speed of rotation, would be required and which would enable you to swing the tide fast and also to do fine training. That, I think, is my own personal contribution to the design of these things.
Why did you go to outside firms rather than, say, Woolwich or the Royal Engineers?
The Royal Engineers wouldn't have been in it at all. They had nothing to do with us. I suppose it was probably because things tended to take rather a long time at Woolwich. And if this was going to come in time for the possible war, it had to be quicker than that. And also, of course, when one had mentioned this need to civilian development concerns, they inclined to get very enthusiastic and to come along and say, oh, we'll produce your prototype for nothing, you see. So, which was a very attractive lure.
You'd say that they were more cooperative?
Very cooperative. They were very keen indeed to do it.
But more cooperative than, say, you get from Woolwich?
Well, Woolwich wouldn't have listened to me. They would have told me, you see, and said, oh, no, you can't do that. No, no, no. We'll have a look at it or something.
You mean there would be a question of rank involved?
No, not rank, but just... Woolwich were the technical experts, and I was an amateur on the fringe, as it were. They wouldn't take my views on what was needed too seriously. I don't say they, if I'd really plugged away at it and gone mad and worked myself to the bone, they might not eventually have done so, but they hadn't taken any initiative themselves on it. There was another thing which was dealt with much the same way, and that was the production of a compass for tanks. My predecessor had got hold of a Russian designer called Shilovsky, who was a grand old man who had originally designed the Whited Torpedo. He's quite a knowledgeable old bird. And he started work on a thing called the Earth Inductor Compass, which was pursued for ages. And we had all sorts of experimental compasses and tanks. Eventually, they were superseded by the sun compass, as war in the desert was more important at that time than war anywhere else.
Would you say then, just to return briefly to the tank, Royal Tank Corps, that what the Tank Corps wanted in terms of design was, in fact, they were able to get? There was a good
What they said they wanted, they got with modifications and amendments. It was a horse trading exercise. The general staff would say what they wanted, and the engineers, design staff, would say, my dear old boy, that's absolutely out of the question. How can you possibly expect to get all that on a tank which mustn't, you say, weigh more than 14 tons? And then there would be a horse trading game which to go on for weeks and sometimes months. So, all right, well, if we drop the subsidiary turret, what can you do? And can we get away with a smaller engine? Or can you have aluminium tracks or any of those sort of things? And it was a long wrangling process until the demand side subsided, never satisfied, of course, but... Well, that's the best we can wring out of them. And then they would make designs and make prototypes, and the process would start all over again.
Was there anybody in particular in the tank corps who was very advanced technically in this side? Any individuals?
No, I don't think so. No one who hadn't gone over onto the technical side.
You mentioned Martel earlier on. Could you say a little bit about him? You were working with him.
Yes. Well, Martel, of course, had been a prominent figure in the tank of World War I. He was one of the staff officers to Sir Hugh Willis. And he had a very intimate knowledge of the tank of the day, and he had fairly advanced ideas on what the tank of the next war should be. He was also a real engineer, a real mechanical engineer, as well as being a sapper, and he was himself a very competent mechanic. In fact, he had a private workshop in his home, and he used to make models of the things he wanted, and very good they were. So he was eventually posted to a post of deputy director in charge of me, and of course he was very receptive to ideas like powered turrets and things of that sort. At the same time, of course, he had a lot of ideas of his own, and he didn't think much of any of the things which were going on. And the first thing I can remember him doing was getting himself sent off on a mission to watch the manoeuvres in Russia. And he came back absolutely steamed up, like nobody's business, with the tremendous power of the Russian tank force, which it has subsequently been found to be entirely correct. They had an enormous number of tanks compared with what anybody else had. I think Martel said that at the manoeuvres he personally saw something in the region of 1,000 tanks. Well, I suppose at that time we had about 50, and the Germans probably had about 200.
Were you very much aware of your deficiency in numbers?
Oh, I think, the tank people were. They didn't believe Martel's 1,000. They thought, well, divide that by 5. It's rather like the stage army. They probably sent them round and round a wood, you see. You saw the same ones over and over again. But it wasn't so. It was quite true. There were 1,000 tanks. But they were all of this Christie type, which they had bought some years ago from America, from an enthusiast called Christie. And Martel then got on the same trail and dashed over to America and got hold of Christie. He found that he still had one chassis left, and that was sent for demonstration. And he then got Lord Nuffield interested in it, and he agreed to put up a factory to make Chinese copies of Liberty engines and Christie tanks.
Were you involved in that at all, this process?
It was mostly done by Martel himself. He was, I don't think he delegated his pet schemes to any extent. No, I was not, until a good deal later when the troubles came, and of course he'd gone by then.
You mentioned that he had his own idea for the tank of the future.
His idea, of course, was very much the same as the Russian one, that he thought light armour and speed was the thing.
And he talked this with you, did he?
No, I don't think so. No. I can't be certain of every conversation. He may have. He, on one or two occasions, he did take me out to lunch and we talked about tank design in general. And I used to give him my few half-baked ideas. I don't think he really talked these things over with anyone. He never got much of a reception from the director, General Davidson, who was very much on another line and had started his own project for what became the infantry tank Mark II, the Matilda, as it's called. Which was a much more heavily armoured vehicle with nothing like the same performance. But as all well knows, it was a very effective tank in battle.
So Davidson, under Ellis, in fact, as well, who was favouring this?
I don't think it was Ellis then, though. I can't remember who it was. Ellis had gone, I think.
But Davidson and Martel, in fact, were seeking two different tanks.
Yes, it was not an orthodox command set up at all. I think they sort of knocked sparks off each other fairly early in their running in double harness, and I think the solution, possibly a very wise one, was that General Davidson said, all right, well, you go and do what you think you want to do, and I'll go on with what I'm doing, you see. And they each did, and they both produced things of some value. But they didn't come down to people like me and say, did I think it was a good idea?
But in fact, you would be working for both of them.
Oh, yes. Directly for Martel. Martel was supposed to be working for General Davidson.
What was your opinion then of Martel as a tank man?
Oh, I thought he was a tremendous chap, yes. I thought he was slightly tortuous sometimes. A bit of a tricky dicky, you know. but very clever, a good engineer, and a man of enormous drive.
Hobart was in the War Office at this time. Did you have much to do with him?
Not very much, because he was there in his capacity as inspector of the tank corps, and he had a small office which he attended occasionally, because he was also commanding the tank brigade at the time. And he had one staff officer who was then a Major Burks, who lived in this office. It was permanently manned by Burks and a secretary. He got all the files which were addressed to the inspector and used to take them down to Tiddle's Head or whatever it happened to be in a motor car as necessary and then bring them back. I had very little to do with him because being another forceful character, he didn't get on too well with Martel. And as they were both sappers, they hadn't got on when they were younger. It was an old one, you see. And so, yes. So that when Hubbard came to the War Office, he had a tendency to send for people like myself, staff captains in MG05, particularly ones who had been in the tank corps, and use us as sort of auxiliary staff officers or office boys or whatever he happened to need at the moment. And that was not to Martel's taste at all, and he gave instructions that if ever General Hubbard wished to see any of his staff, that they would come to him and obtain permission first. And as he didn't always give it, we didn't see as much of Hubbard as we might have.
But were you aware of Hubbard's ideas at this time, or at least...
Well, yes, his ideas were that everything that anyone was doing was all a lot of damn nonsense, and why couldn't he have an enormous tank weighing 20-30 tons, you see, which was self-supporting and could range all over the back areas of the battlefield carrying its own food with it. That sort of concept appeared to be the idea, and he persuaded the General Staff to put out new specifications for these large capital tanks, which were accepted, sort of design schemes were got out. The original one to the full GS specification got the name of A14, and that was modified as being not practical with the engineering of the time. And so a modified GS specification tank called A15 was the one which was worked on until it was overcome by other designs made necessary by the times. I mean, these things like Matilda and the Christie tank were all developing in parallel, and eventually these A14 and A15 concepts were pushed into the background, and they never got further than the drawing board.
Did he, in fact, on those, he was involved in that, did he go to Vickers himself, or did he get involved?
Oh, yes, he went to Vickers a lot. Oh, yes. All of us did. We spent a lot of time with all the firms who were working for us, and we all were on very cordial... yes, in fact, I made a great many friendships at that time, which were not only very helpful to me and other stages of my career, but I have formed sort of close friendships which carried on into the days after my retirement, and some of these individuals leaving the firms and concerned.
How much influence did the Royal Artillery and the Royal Engineers have on tank design?
Very little. The Royal Artillery depended on the crumbs, rather, which fell from the tank table. Their requirement was for a self-propelled gun, you see, and so it usually took the form of the bottom half of a tank, slightly adapted, on which they stuck a gun. But the mechanics of the thing, the tracks and the engine and all that, were generally the same as those of a tank. The engineers had very little to do with tanks, except in the development of tank auxiliary devices, such as the scissors bridge, and a bridge which is mounted on a tank, folded up, and then can be unfolded like scissors and put across the other side of the ditch, and then it and subsequent tanks can go over it. There were a number of those sort of projects. I think they were involved in the De Thorens searchlight project, which later became the canal defence light, which you may have heard of or may not. But it was a thing which was based on a rather hazy concept of blinding the enemy with light flashing on and off at a critical speed. And it was, you couldn't shoot the light out because the optics were arranged so that it was projected through a very thin slit. In fact, that concept turned out to be a lot of nonsense, although a lot of these tanks were made, and its only useful job was in lighting the passage over the Rhine in the final stages of the war.
Did you find that in your design demands that you had to consult the engineers for any particular items that you were doing?
Well, no, I don't suppose we did. The design department would have, but I had nothing to do with that, really.
What about signals at the time? Were you very
Oh, yes, there was quite a lot to do with signals. Development of wireless sets was going on the whole time. And, of course, these things like signalling lamps and whatnot were also very much in the picture. And the signals came into that.
Would you say that in your dealings with Vickers, they were, in fact, dictating policy in any way?
They may have wished to, but I don't think they ever did. The main quarrel, if you can call it that, they had with the War Office and its pundits was that they reckoned that there was a very obvious limit to the size of any vehicle you could build with the then available components. For instance, if I may, there was no commercial engine in this country bigger than an 8-litre bus engine. Now, that produced, I forget, perhaps 125 horsepower, something like that. Well, that's not enough for a heavy tank. And so you've got a situation where, in order to be able to employ commercial engines and avoid the enormous time and cost of developing a special one of your own, you had to couple one or more of these to each other. The Matilda had two of these AEC engines coupled together with many attendant troubles. And, of course, the same thing happened later when the Americans came into the war. They had to power their Sherman tanks. In one version, they coupled five Chrysler motor car engines together in the form of a sort of Jewish star. But, you see, developing specialised engines was scarcely on at that time. The Air Force were doing it with Rolls-Royce, but it was an immensely expensive operation and took a very long time. And it's one of the things we couldn't afford to do, so we had to have what we could get until later, in the early days of the wars, when the Churchill tent came on, Vauxhall did succeed in producing, in designing and producing a new flat 12-cylinder, I think it was, engine of their own, which eventually became reasonably successful, though it suffered every known teething trouble that any engine is heir to.
Was the problem then that there was no clearly defined specification from the general staff as to what sort of tank they wanted?
Oh yes, there was, but it was impossible. Yeah. We couldn't make it. Mm. Everyone knew we couldn't make it, probably including the general staff. But I think they worked on the theory that ask for the moon and you'll get a small planet.
Did Vickers cooperate much with Woolwich? What was the relationship between
them? It was not always the friendliest cooperation, but it was certainly constant. They had to, because they had to know all the details of the armament and the territory, you see.
So there would be a constant flow of of visits and things?
Yes. Yes, the officers of the design department would be down at Chertsey as often as I was, which is saying quite a lot.
Did you test your components, the various work you were doing? How much detail did you, how much time did you spend on testing?
Well, of course, I didn't spend any time on testing, but the people who were developing these components had to spend a lot of time in the various factories where they were being designed and made. The Merritt Brown transmission, which was developed under the guidance of Dr. Merritt, who was induced to join the design department in Woolwich, he worked with David Brown of Huddleston. Anyway, they have several factories, call it Peniston, on this design, and they made it for him, and they did all the rig testing for him. I think it was also done probably in the arsenal at Woolwich, either in parallel or subsequently. Well, things were tested, not exhaustively perhaps, but they were.
I was asking the question because there has been criticism that during the early war years, a lot of equipment broke down. Yes. The reliability was poor.
Oh, yes, it was.
Was this because, do you think, of bad testing?
No, it was because everything was done in such a hurry.